As always, really excited about the show I've put together for you today, especially since legendary NFL referee Jim Tunney will be sharing stories with us. He was a referee for 3 Super Bowls, also the catch game, Tom Dempsey's record-setting 63-yard field goal. He's been around for a lot of football history and saw a lot of history even before he got to the NFL, as his dad was a college official on the West Coast. So you're going to hear some great stories from Jim Tunney. The Colts and Cowboys play each other this week, as do the 49ers and Dolphins. Those are 2 matchups of teams who played against each other in the Super Bowl. I'm going to go over those Super Bowls with you. That was Super Bowl 5, which was won in the last seconds by the Colts with a game-winning field goal kicked by Jim O'Brien, and Super Bowl 19 between the 49ers and Dolphins. Joe Montana set a Super Bowl record that I think you're going to be surprised to know that Joe Montana held. Also going to look into the conference championship games happening in college football this week. And through that, you'll hear a little bit about Jim Harbaugh's quarterbacking history when he played for the University of Michigan, and tell you why the season for TCU and Georgia is historic for those schools, as well as a story about Dabo Swinney and Mac Brown when Swinney first got the job at Clemson. A lot of history, a lot of here and now. I'm Jackson Michael. This is The Game Before the Money on the Sports Map Radio Network and the Sports Map Radio app. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com and check out the Game Before the Money podcast wherever you get your podcasts. It's conference football championship weekend in college football. I'm an old school guy. I, for one, preferred the regular season determining champions in the days before conference championships. But hey, it's not like I'm not going to watch these games. There used to be a long wait between the college football regular season and the bowl games. These conference championship games help close that gap. It's extra football, so I'm certainly not going to complain about that either, even if a few of these games are rematches and kind of a second chance sweepstakes for teams to win their conference championship. But some of these games are first time matchups for this season, however, most notably the ACC, SEC, and the Big Ten. Let's first talk about the ACC championship game. Clemson and North Carolina. I think the ACC is underrated by the rankings. Here you have Dabo Swinney going up against Mac Brown. I mean, what's not to love about that? The two have only coached against each other once since Mac Brown returned to North Carolina. That was in 2019, and Clemson escaped with a 1-point victory. Dabo Swinney and Mac Brown go back further than that, however. When Swinney was hired to be the head coach at Clemson, he called several top-notch coaches around the country asking for guidance. Mac Brown was the only coach to return his call and invited Dabo Swinney and his staff to Texas. Brown also sat down with Swinney for several hours. Swinney said the two biggest things he learned from Brown was to be himself and how to manage his time as a head coach. This ACC championship should be a good game. Of course, I've told you about North Carolina receiver Josh Downs since before the season started. And despite missing games to injury, Downs still finished tied for 6th in the nation with 11 touchdown catches. I think this is going to end up being a really fun game to watch. Moving on to the Big Ten. Michigan against Purdue. This is the 60th meeting between the two schools. I don't know. I would have thought there might have been more games. They first played each other in the 1890s, but went many years between 1900 and 1945 without playing each other. Michigan has won 45 of the previous matchups between these schools, including the last four. Purdue has only two winning streaks against Michigan in their entire history. They had a two-game win streak in 2008 and 2009. The Boilermakers won five straight against Michigan from 1962 through 1966. And that's it. That's the only two times in history that Purdue has won consecutive games against Michigan. So Michigan has dominated this series. Current Michigan head coach Jim Harbaugh played quarterback for Michigan in the 1980s. He started against Purdue in his junior and senior seasons. Michigan soundly defeated Purdue both times. In the game against Purdue in Harbaugh's senior year, he became Michigan's all-time completions leader. And on that same day, Michigan head coach Bo Schembechler tied the school record for most career coaching victories. A quick note about Purdue head coach Jeff Brohm. He is 3-0 coaching against teams ranked in the top three. When asked about it this week, he said, "You have to play your best game and have luck on your side. A lot has to go right for Purdue to win this game, but when nobody's giving you a chance, occasionally teams surprise people in those games. We should probably know by halftime if Purdue has any chance to win this game." Okay, let's talk Big 12 for a moment. Undefeated TCU playing against Kansas State. TCU defeated Kansas State earlier in the season. Going all the way back to my college football preview in July, I said that these were two teams I was very interested in the Big 12. And here they are in the conference championship game. I'm not here just goofing off on the microphone, all right? I want to give you the best historical stories and current insight that you can get in an hour program. TCU and Kansas State first played each other in 1922, and then they didn't play each other again until the 1980s. This is only the 17th time that Kansas State and TCU have played each other, and each has won eight times. So this game will not only give one team the Big 12 championship, it will put the winning school above the other in head-to-head matchups all time. Kansas State is 9-3 this season coming into this. All three losses to ranked opponents, including TCU. TCU has had an historic season. They have a chance to finish unbeaten and untied for only the third time in program history. The first time was in 1938 with Heisman Trophy winner Davey O'Brien at quarterback. You may have heard of the Davey O'Brien Award. That's whom it's named after. O'Brien was TCU's quarterback after the great Sammy Baugh quarterbacked the Horned Frogs. This year's TCU team is tied with Tennessee for most victories over ranked opponents with five. I really think this game is going to come down to the fourth quarter. Main event of the conference championships. Gotta go SEC here. Georgia and LSU. These teams have not played each other yet this season. As you regular listeners know, I don't really like to go out and make flat-out predictions, but I do think that Georgia is the best team in college football this year. They have played the most consistent and most dominant football, in my opinion, with all respects to Michigan and TCU, who are also undefeated. Georgia has just looked the best to me, comparing the games that I have seen. Only two current LSU players played in the 2019 SEC championship game. Georgia played in this game last year, and although they lost to Alabama, they did win the national championship. The Bulldogs have a lot more big game experience, and I think that is really going to make a difference here, regardless of whether this game turns out to be close or not. I really think for LSU to win, they're going to have to play their best game, and Georgia would have to make a lot of mistakes. Anything can happen, but Georgia really has what I see as a lot of advantages going into this game, and a lot would have to go right for LSU to stay within striking distance. This is the first time in Georgia history that the Bulldogs have had back-to-back undefeated regular seasons, and this senior class has the most wins of any class in school history. That dates back all the way to the late 1800s. If you're a Georgia fan, this is a very special group. On Thursday, the college football playoff announced that it is expanding to 12 teams starting in 2024. Gauging from the press release, it looks like the top four teams will have a bye, and then the 12th seed will play at the number five seed. So there will be some home games for some teams in this format. And the 2024 quarterfinals will be the Fiesta Bowl, Peach Bowl, Rose Bowl, and Sugar Bowl. The Cotton Bowl and Orange Bowl will be the semifinal games, with the championship game being in Atlanta. I've talked about how I prefer the four-team format. And like I've said before, we wanted a playoff for situations where there were two or more undefeated teams, like in 1997 with Michigan and Nebraska. I'm Jackson Michael. This is The Game Before the Money, airing Saturdays at 11 a.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Central, on the Sports Map Radio Network and the Sports Map Radio app. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com and check out the Game Before the Money podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Two NFL games this week featured teams that played each other in the Super Bowl. I thought it would be fun to remember those Super Bowls. The San Francisco 49ers play the Miami Dolphins this week. Both teams are in first place in their divisions, and both teams played each other in Super Bowl 19. The Indianapolis Colts play at Dallas this weekend. Those two franchises played each other in Super Bowl 5 when the Colts were still in Baltimore. Super Bowl 5 between the Dallas Cowboys and Baltimore Colts was the Super Bowl for the 1970 season, the first season after the AFL and NFL merged. During the season, both the Colts and Cowboys players each held mid-season player meetings. Colts quarterback Johnny Unitas told his players to forget Super Bowl III and to move on. He told the team that he believed they could win the Super Bowl if they worked together and moved past complaining about that bitter loss to the Jets in Super Bowl III. The Cowboys' defense held a team meeting after they lost to the divisional rival Cardinals 38-0 on Monday Night Football. Defensive back Herb Adderley, who formerly played for Vince Lombardi's Green Bay Packers, told his teammates that he had never played on a team that finished worse than 8-6, and he refused to start doing that now. The Colts won their last four regular season games to win their division. Likewise, the Cowboys didn't lose after that humiliating defeat against the Cardinals. Both teams won their conference championship games, the first ever AFC and NFC championship games. Super Bowl V is often called the Blooper Bowl or the Blunder Bowl because of so many turnovers. The Colts turned the ball over seven times in Super Bowl V and still won the game, 16-13. Colts rookie Jim O'Brien kicked the game-winning field goal with 5 seconds left on the clock to give Baltimore the win. Earlier in the week, O'Brien had a dream about one of the teams lining up to kick a game-winning field goal, but in his dream, he couldn't tell if it was the Cowboys or the Colts lining up. In real life, it turned out to be Jim O'Brien and the Colts. Jim O'Brien's game-winning field goal was the bookend on his rookie season. He kicked a last-minute game-winning field goal for the Colts in week one against San Diego. Cowboys defensive tackle Bob Lilly threw his helmet up high in the air in frustration after the game-winning field goal was kicked. The Cowboys had previously lost in the final moments in the 1966 and 1967 NFL championship games, and Lilly's helmet toss spoke to the heartbreak of all of those losses. Dallas recovered to win the Super Bowl the next year. Super Bowl V isn't discussed very often today. The Colts' 1971 media guide called it, quote, one of the zaniest games ever. Dick Young of the New York Daily News wrote that he couldn't decide whether he'd seen one of the best games ever or one of the worst. Ed Pope of the Miami Herald wrote that the two teams may have not looked like Super Bowl teams, but they engaged in, quote, super combat. It was a hard-fought, punishing game, and that's a good indicator of why there were so many fumbles. There were 11 turnovers between the two teams. The Colts were coached by Don McCafferty, who took over before the 1970 season when Don Shula left for Miami. McCafferty played college football at Ohio State under legendary coach Paul Brown. Don McCafferty isn't a well-known coach, especially for a Super Bowl winning coach during that time period. He stood 6'5" and was the tallest coach in the NFL. Don McCafferty is one of two coaches in NFL history to win a Super Bowl in their first season as an NFL head coach. The other is George Seifert. I know some 49er fans out there got that one. Don McCafferty didn't last long with the Colts. The team came under new ownership early in his tenure. The new GM fired McCafferty mid-season, reportedly because he wouldn't bench Johnny Unitas. Now, there's some trivia there. What coach was fired for not benching Johnny Unitas? McCafferty was then hired by the Lions, but only coached one season before tragically dying from a heart attack at age 53. Don McCafferty is remembered as a player's coach, whose nickname was Easy Rider because of his soft-spoken style. The Colts play at Dallas this weekend in a rematch of Super Bowl V. There will also be a rematch of Super Bowl XIX in San Francisco this weekend as the Dolphins take on the 49ers. Super Bowl XIX was won by the 49ers 38-16. That game is historic for pitting young quarterbacks Joe Montana and Dan Marino against one another. Although Montana was in his sixth season and had already won a Super Bowl, Marino was only in his second year. Nobody knew that both of these quarterbacks would end up on the short list of greatest of all time, or that Joe Montana would win four Super Bowls, or that Dan Marino was playing in the only Super Bowl of his Hall of Fame career. Super Bowl XIX is also historic because of the head coaches, Bill Walsh facing off against Don Shula. Although Coach Shula was already acknowledged as an all-time great, Coach Walsh had only won one Super Bowl up to this point. Nobody knew that Walsh would end up with more Super Bowl wins than Don Shula. Montana versus Marino, Walsh versus Shula. In retrospect, this game was as historic as you could get. Although, watching it at the time, we didn't know that. I remember watching this game. President Reagan performed the coin toss for Super Bowl XIX via satellite from the White House. It was on the same day that he was inaugurated for his second term. So a big day for President Reagan there. Hall of Famer Hugh McElhenney also took part in the coin toss, and future Hall of Famer Dwight Stevenson called heads for the Dolphins. The 49ers won the toss and elected to receive. Back then, that's what teams did. Rarely did a team defer to the second half. The hype leading up to this game was that it was going to be a high-scoring affair between the league's two best offenses. San Francisco was 15-1 during the regular season, and Miami was 14-2. Both teams cruised through the playoffs. Neither had trailed for a single second. And Marino had a record-setting season, becoming the first quarterback to throw for over 5,000 yards in a single season. He also set the single-season touchdown pass record with 48, breaking the previous record by 12. It turned out to indeed be a high-scoring game, but only for one team, the San Francisco 49ers. 49ers head coach Bill Walsh saw that two of the Dolphins linebackers were inexperienced. One was a rookie and one was in his second year. He also noted that San Francisco's offensive tackle Bubba Paris weighed 40 pounds more than the Dolphins' defensive end. He expected to gain yardage running behind Paris, and he thought that his running backs Roger Craig and Wendell Tyler could beat Miami's linebackers. And the plan proved true, as Craig and Tyler combined for over 120 yards rushing and 140 yards receiving. Roger Craig scored 3 touchdowns in that game. Miami's game plan tried to cross up San Francisco's defense with a hurry-up offense. It worked at first. Miami had a 10-7 lead at the end of the first quarter. Shula hoped he could force the 49ers into a nickel defense and establish the run. 49er defensive coordinator George Seifert, there's that name again, kept his main pass rushers Fred Dean and Gary Big Hands Johnson on the field for every down, since he didn't have time to sub them in on passing downs. Dean and Johnson pressured Marino more than he had been pressured all season. The 49ers were able to get pressure without blitzing, allowing their linebackers to stay back. That was key in this game. In the second quarter, the 49ers scored 3 touchdowns during a stretch in which Miami had 1 yard of total offense. The Dolphins kicked 2 field goals before the half ended, but San Francisco held firm control of the game at that point and won 38-16. Joe Montana set the Super Bowl record for most passing yards, 331 at the time, and most rushing yards by a quarterback with 59. That rushing record stood until Super Bowl 34, when Steve McNair rushed for 64 yards, and that is still the record. I remember Super Bowl 19 as the game that really established the 49ers championship standard. The catch and the road to Super Bowl 16 was really seen as magic. The 15-1 season and the crushing of Miami was seen as methodical. And the next year, the team would draft a player out of Mississippi Valley State named Jerry Rice. I'm Jackson Michael. This is The Game Before the Money. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. Up next, an interview with legendary referee Jim Tunney, the referee for the catch game. The Game Before the Money airs Saturdays at 11 a.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Central on the Sports Map Radio Network and the Sports Map Radio app. Was really grateful to have an opportunity to chat with legendary NFL referee Jim Tunney, who spent 31 years as an official in the NFL from 1960 through 1990. He was the referee in Super Bowl VI, Super Bowl XI, and Super Bowl XII. He also was the referee for the catch game, Tom Dempsey's record-setting 63-yard field goal. He was an alternate for the Ice Bowl, so he was at that game as well. And he has some really great stories to share with us today. You can hear the full interview on the Game Before the Money podcast.
You grew up in Los Angeles?
Grew up in Los Angeles in the San Gabriel Valley, actually, just east of Los Angeles.
And how did you first get involved in sports?
Well, my dad was an official, and I followed him around when he would go to games and officiate, I would carry his gear bag. But I'd go through the ticket gateway. My dad just say, that's my assistant behind me with my officiating uniform. So I went to games with him many times at 5, 6, 7 years of age.
Oh, what, were those like UCLA games or were those?
I went to the Coliseum for USC and UCLA, and then lots of my travel up down the coast to Stanford and Cal and places like that. Many games in the Rose Bowl when Jackie Robinson was playing for Pasadena Junior College, places like that, yeah.
Oh, wow. So you remember Jackie Robinson in college then?
I was sitting on the bench one day when Jackie was playing for Pasadena Junior College, and my dad came over at halftime and said, "You watch this little kid here, number 28, he's going to be reading something someday." And he certainly was.
Wow. Wow, that is incredible. And then you went to high school. Did you start officiating right after high school, or when did you get started?
I started in college when I went to Occidental College about my junior year. They needed officials for the interscholastic games, intramural type thing. And since I'd been around officiating a long time, I felt I was ready. It was for free, didn't get paid.
How did the NFL find you?
Well, I was working with in USC and UCLA in the, what they called then the Pacific Coast Conference. Wasn't called the Pac-12. And I worked at an intersectional game, I think it was probably UCLA in Texas. And they saw me. I never applied to the NFL. They saw me and asked me if I would like to join them. That was the same year, you know, as the AFL started. So the AFL called me in 1960 because they didn't have any officials. They called me and I wanted to find work in the AFL, and I said I would. And the NFL called me the very next day and said, "Don't sign with the AFL. We want you to work in the NFL." There was a big fight going on in 1960 between AFL and the NFL.
Wow! So the battle that the NFL and AFL had, it even went down to the officiating crews too.
Yes, sir.
And then what do you remember about your first game in the NFL in 1960?
My first game was in the Los Angeles Coliseum between the Chicago Bears and George Halas in the Los Angeles Rams. And I remember meeting Mr. Halas. He's a guy who founded the NFL. He was the owner of the Chicago Bears. It was kind of like meeting Tom Edison, you know. Here's a guy who created the whole thing. I was very honored to work the game. So being George Halas was a great honor for me.
Wow, what a thrill. What a great start to your NFL officiating career.
Yeah.
You know, I guess one of the first really famous games, or at least that I know of that you were a part of, was the 1965 West Division playoff between the Colts and Packers.
In 65, yeah, it was in Green Bay, and they had a controversial call on a field goal that I called good. That Don Shula, coach, all of our coach didn't like, but the Green Bay Packers won it. And I worked a lot of controversial games. One of them, of course, was the 1967 Ice Bowl. I was there for that as an alternate referee.
I've read that the officials' whistles weren't working. Is that right? And they verbally called the plays down?
The whistle stuck. They call it the P. When you blow the whistle, the P bounces around and makes the noise of the whistle. Whistle actually stuck to the officials' lips.
And you called Tom Dempsey's 63-yard field goal.
I was there in 1970. November 8th, Tom Dempsey kicked it, set the record of 63 yards at the time. And I've known Tom for a long time. Went to junior college in Southern California, and he had a foot that was deformed. And so he had a deformed shoe on the foot, on the deformed foot, and he kicked it 63 yards straight on. Not like these guys that they are kicking with a soccer kick, but this was a straight on kick by Dempsey.
When he lined up, did you think he had a chance to make it, or did it surprise you? Or
they were kicking from their own 37-yard line where he lined up, and so 63 yards, and Alex Harris of the Detroit Lions said, "What are they going to do?" I said, "They're going to kick a field goal." "Did you tell them they're on their own 37-yard line?" I said, "I don't make those decisions, Alex. Let's get out of the play." So he kicked it, went right through. He won the game once the clock went to 0-0. It was cold that day. It was a November day in New Orleans, actually Tulane, at Tulane Stadium. The Superdome was not built yet. They played it in Tulane Stadium.
Your first Super Bowl was Super Bowl VI. How did you find you got assigned it?
Art McNally called me on Tuesday before the game, and I said, "You got it." I said, "I got what?" He said, "You got the Super Bowl. You're the referee in Super Bowl VI." And I was honored and shocked that you get the assignment in Super Bowl. For officials, that's the greatest thing you could have, in being assigned a Super Bowl game. We were very much honored. So I was honored. I was only 42. I was the youngest official to referee a Super Bowl game.
And you were the referee at the catch game, too. What do you remember about the catch play?
Well, I remember that Joe didn't know the calls. He went over to talk to Coach Walsh, and I didn't know what they were doing, except I found out later Joe was supposed to throw the ball to Freddie Solomon. Freddie was a great receiver. And he said, "If Solomon is open, throw it away." So when the play happened and Solomon was covered pretty good, Montana had to throw it some late. He threw it over very high in the end zone, and Dwight Clark jumped up, caught it. I never saw the catch because I followed Montana. He got knocked to the ground by Ed Tuzon Jones. I followed him all the way to the ground until I saw the play was over. I saw that Dwight Clark had caught the pass.
What was the reaction of Montana when he got up?
Well, when he was on the ground, he didn't see the catch either. Ed Tuzon Jones was lying on top of him, and when he looked up, he said, "What happened?" I said, "You threw it and it stands." He said, "What?" I said, "No." I said, "Dwight Clark caught. You got a touchdown." And that won the game for him, and they went to the first Super Bowl for the 49ers with that catch.
What was it like for you as a referee once replay came in? Do you remember your first kind of encounter with instant replay, or your first experience with it?
The law officials didn't like it, so their judgment was being questioned. And I said, "That's what you do. You're out here in the field. Your judgment is going to get questioned. And if we get the play right, that's what we're all about. We want to get the play correct. We don't want to have any team or a player offended or disregarded because of what happened in the field. We want to get the play right."
How much pressure did you feel while you were doing that?
You don't feel any pressure. You just watch the game. Do what you're supposed to do. If you prepare yourself for the game when something like that happens, make the call if it's there. If it's not there, just be sure everybody's okay.
Yeah, now you've been out of the league for a while. Do you stay in touch?
I watch a lot of football, a lot of games on Monday night, Thursday night, Sunday, all day long. Just to see how the officials are doing. And glad to see that there's so many of them that are doing a great job.
All right, some stories there from legendary NFL referee Jim Tunney, who still keeps an eye on football on TV now, keeps up with the game. Some fantastic stories from him about being on the field as the catch was made. If you watch the highlight of the play, you actually see Jim Tunney shadow Joe Montana as Montana runs towards the sideline and makes that throw. And just some fantastic stories that Mr. Tunney shared about his career and growing up. Pretty amazing story about seeing Jackie Robinson playing in junior college in a game his dad officiated. And also just some insight on how he got the call to be the referee for Super Bowl VI, one of three Super Bowls that Jim Tunney was the referee for. You can listen to the rest of the interview on the Game Before the Money podcast. He talks about being the referee for the 1979 AFC Championship game and the famous Mike Renfro play. You'll want to hear that. He shared some really good George Allen stories as well. And that doesn't even cover it all. I mean, Jim Tunney was the referee for the Fog Bowl game. He was also the referee for the fumble, the 1987 AFC Championship game. And who knew? Jim Tunney was actually part of the AFL-NFL war. Who knew until he shared that with us in this interview? Remember, you can hear the entire interview on the Game Before the Money podcast. Jim Tunney has a website, jimtunney.com. You'll want to visit that. You can learn about the Jim Tunney Youth Foundation. There's a Jim Tunney bobblehead on the website that you'll want to check out. And he also has written a book called Impartial Judgment. And you can learn more about all of that at jimtunney.com. I'm Jackson Michael. This is the Game Before the Money. Be sure to visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. All right, special thanks again to Jim Tunney for sharing those great stories with us. And you can hear more on the Game Before the Money podcast. I didn't have time to do the crazy stat record of the week yet, so I'm going to do it right now, and it relates a little bit to Jim Tunney, as he was the referee for Super Bowl VI. In Super Bowl VI was the longest sack ever recorded in a Super Bowl. That was done by Bob Lilly, Hall of Fame defensive tackle Bob Lilly from TCU. He sacked Miami Dolphins quarterback Bob Greasy for a 29-yard loss in Super Bowl VI. And that stands the record for the longest sack in Super Bowl history. Bob Lilly is a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame and the Texas Sports Hall of Fame. You can hear him share stories in episode 10 of the Texas Sports Hall of Fame podcast, which I also host. Bob Lilly, a great man, great player, and was very thankful to be able to chat with him for episode 10 of the Texas Sports Hall of Fame podcast. And quickly, our Pro Football Hall of Famer of the Week, mostly people who played long ago but are important names to know in football history. This week, we'll talk about Ernie Nevers. Ernie Nevers holds the oldest record in the NFL. In 1929, he scored 40 points in a single game. He scored 6 touchdowns and kicked 4 extra points. Only a handful of players have scored 6 touchdowns in one game. Ernie Nevers also played Major League Baseball for the St. Louis Browns. Ernie Nevers was part of the Pro Football Hall of Fame's original class of 1963. I'm Jackson Michael. Thanks for listening to The Game Before the Money. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com.